and the three new men. Joe Turbor, Visicaster, bulky and plump-lipped. Dr. Elvit Semik, professor emeritus of physics at the university, scrawny and wrinkled, his clothes only half-filled. Homer Munn, librarian, lanky and terribly ill at ease. Dr. Darrell spoke easily, in a normal, matter-of-fact tone. This gathering has been arranged, gentlemen, for a trifle more than merely social reasons. You may have guessed this. Since you have been deliberately chosen because of your backgrounds, you may also guess the danger involved. I won't minimize it, but I will point out that we are all condemned men, in any case. You will notice that none of you have been invited with any attempt at secrecy. None of you have been asked to come here unseen. The windows are not adjusted to non-insight. No screen of any sort is about the room. We have only to attract the attention of the enemy to be ruined, and the best way to attract that attention is to assume a false and theatrical secrecy. Ha! Thought Arcadia, bending over the voices coming, a bit screechily, out of the little box. Do you understand that? Elvit Semik twitched his lower lip and bared his teeth in the screw-up, wrinkled gesture that preceded his every sentence. Oh, get on with it. Tell us about the youngster.
The best,
Dr. Darrell said. Peleus Anthor is his name. He was a student of my old colleague, Cleese, who died last year. Cleese sent me his brain pattern to the fifth sublevel before he died, which pattern has now been checked against that of the man before you. You know, of course, that a brain pattern cannot be duplicated that far, even by men of the science of psychology. If you don't know that, you'll have to take my word for it. Turbor said, purse-lipped, we might as well make a beginning somewheres. We'll take your word for it, especially since you're the greatest electroneurologist in the galaxy, now that Cleese is dead. At least, that is the way I've described you in my Visicast comment, and I even believe it myself. How old are you, Anthor? 29, Mr. Turbor. And are you an electroneurologist, too? A great one? Just a student of the science, but I work hard, and I've had the benefit of Cleese's training. Munn broke in. He had a slight stammer at periods of tension. I wish you'd get started. I think everyone's talking too much. Dr. Darrell lifted an eyebrow in Munn's direction. You're right, Homer. Take over, Peleus. Not for a while, said Peleus Anthor slowly. Because before we can get started, although I appreciate Mr. Munn's sentiment, I must request brainwave data. Darrell frowned. What is this, Anthor? What brainwave data do you refer to? The patterns of all of you. You have taken mine, Dr. Darrell. I must take yours and those of the rest of you. And I must take the measurements myself. Turbor said. There's no reason for him to trust us, Darrell. The young man is within his rights. Thank you, said Anthor. If you'll lead the way to your laboratory, then, Dr. Darrell, we'll proceed. I took the liberty this morning of checking your apparatus. The science of electroencephalography was at once new and old. It was old in the sense that the knowledge of the microcircuits generated by nerve cells of living beings belonged to that immense category of human knowledge, whose origin was completely lost. It was knowledge that stretched back as far as the earliest remnants of human history, and yet it was new, too. The fact of the existence of microcurrents slumbered through the tens of thousands of years of galactic empire as one of those vivid and whimsical but quite useless items of human knowledge. Some had attempted to form classifications of waves into waking and sleeping, calm and excited, well and ill, but even the broadest conceptions had had their hordes of vitiating exceptions. Others had tried to show the existence of brainwave groups, analogous to the well-known blood groups, and to show that external environment was the defining factor. These were the race-minded people who claimed that man could be divided into subspecies. But such a philosophy could make no headway against the overwhelming ecumenical drive involved in the fact of Galactic Empire, one political unit covering 20 million stellar systems, involving all of man from the central world of Trantor, now a gorgeous and impossible memory of the great past, to the loneliest asteroid on the periphery. And then again, in a society given over, as that of the First Empire was, to the physical sciences and inanimate technology, there was a vague but mighty sociological push away from the study of the mind. It was less respectable because less immediately useful. It was poorly financed since it was less profitable. After the disintegration of the First Empire, there came the fragmentation of organized science, back, passed even the fundamentals of atomic power into the chemical power of coal and oil. The one exception to this, of course, was the first foundation, where the spark of science, revitalized and grown more intense, was maintained and fed to flame. Yet there, too, it was the physical that ruled, and the brain, except for surgery, was neglected ground. Harry Seldon was the first to express what afterwards came to be accepted as truth. Neural microcurrents, he said once, carry within them the spark of every varying impulse and response, conscious and unconscious. The brainwaves, recorded on neatly squared paper in trembling peaks and troughs, are the mirrors of the combined thought pulses of billions of cells. Theoretically, analysis should reveal the thoughts and emotions of the subject, to the last and least. Differences should be detected that are due not only to gross physical defects, inherited or acquired, but also to shifting states of emotion, to advancing education and experience, even to something as subtle as a change in the subject's philosophy of life. But even Seldon could approach no further than speculation. And now for 50 years, the men of the First Foundation had been tearing at that incredibly vast and complicated storehouse of new knowledge. The approach, naturally, was made through new techniques, as, for example, the use of electrodes at skull sutures by a newly developed means which enabled contact to be made directly with the gray cells, without even the necessity of shaving a patch of skull. And then there was a recording device which automatically recorded the brainwave data as an overall total and as separate functions of 6 independent variables. What was most significant, perhaps, was the growing respect in which encephalography and the encephalographer was held. Cleese, the greatest of them, sat at scientific conventions on an equal basis with the physicist. Dr. Darrell, though no longer active in the science, was known for his brilliant advances in encephalographic analysis, almost as much as for the fact that he was the son of Beta Darrell, the great heroine of the past generation. And so now, Dr. Darrell sat in his own chair, with the delicate touch of the feathery electrodes scarcely hinting at pressure upon his skull, while the vacuum-encased needles wavered to and fro. His back was to the recorder. Otherwise, as was well known, the sight of the moving curves induced an unconscious effort to control them, with noticeable results. But he knew that the central dial was expressing the strongly rhythmic and little varying sigma curve, which was to be expected of his own powerful and disciplined mind. It would be strengthened and purified in the subsidiary dial dealing with the cerebellar wave. There would be the sharp, near discontinuous leaps from the frontal lobe, and the subdued shakiness from the subsurface regions with its narrow range of frequencies. He knew his own brainwave pattern, much as an artist might be perfectly aware of the color of his eyes. Pelias Anthor made no comment when Darrell rose from the reclining chair. The young man abstracted the 7 recordings, glanced at them with the quick, all-embracing eyes of one who knows exactly what tiny facet of near nothingness is being looked for. "If you don't mind, Dr. Semmick?" Semmick's age-yellowed face was serious. Electroencephalography was a science of his old age, of which he knew little, an upstart that he faintly resented. He knew that he was old, and that his wave pattern would show it. The wrinkles on his face showed it, the stoop in his walk, the shaking of his hand, but they spoke only of his body. The brainwave patterns might show that his mind was old, too. An embarrassing and unwarranted invasion of a man's last protecting stronghold, his own mind. The electrodes were adjusted. The process did not hurt, of course, from beginning to end. There was just that tiny tingle, far below the threshold of sensation. And then came Terbor, who sat quietly and unemotionally through the 15-minute process, and Munn, who jerked at the first touch of the electrodes, and then spent the session rolling his eyes, as though he wished he could turn them backwards, and watch through a hole in his occiput. "And now," said Darrell, when all was done, "and now," said Anthor apologetically, "there is one more person in the house." Darrell, frowning, said, "My daughter?" "Yes. I suggested that she stay home tonight, if you'll remember." "For encephalographical analysis? What in the galaxy for?" "I cannot proceed without it." Darrell shrugged and climbed the stairs. Arcadia, amply warned, had the sound receiver off when he entered, then followed him down with mild obedience. It was the first time in her life, except for the taking of her basic mind pattern as an infant, for identification and registration purposes, that she found herself under the electrodes. "May I see?" she asked, when it was over, holding out her hand. Dr. Darrell said, You would not understand, Arcadia. Isn't it time for you to go to bed? Yes, father, she said demurely. Good night, all. She ran up the stairs and plumped into bed with a minimum of basic preparation. With Olynthus's sound receiver propped beside her pillow, she felt like a character out of a book film, and hugged every moment of it close to her chest in an ecstasy of spy stuff. The first words she heard were Anthor's, and they were, "The analyses, gentlemen, are all satisfactory. The child as well." Child, she thought disgustedly, and bristled at Anthor in the darkness. Anthor had opened his briefcase now, and out of it he took several dozen brainwave records. They were not originals. Nor had the briefcase been fitted with an ordinary lock. Had the key been held in any other hand than his, the contents thereof would have silently and instantly oxidized into an indecipherable ash. Once removed from the briefcase, the records did so anyway, after half an hour. But during their short lifetime, Anthor spoke quickly. "I have the records here of several minor government officials at Anacreon. This is a psychologist at Locris University. This is an industrialist at Siwena. The rest are as you see." They crowded closely. To all but Daryl, they were so many quivers on parchment. To Daryl, they shouted with a million tongues. Anthor pointed lightly. "I call your attention, Dr. Daryl, to the plateau region among the secondary Tauian waves in the frontal lobe, which is what all these records have in common. Would you use my analytical rule, sir, to check my statement?" The analytical rule might be considered a distant relation, as a skyscraper is to a shack, of that kindergarten toy, the logarithmic slide rule. Daryl used it with the wrist flip of long practice. He made freehand drawings of the result, and, as Anthor stated, there were featureless plateaus in frontal lobe regions where strong swings should have been expected. "How would you interpret that, Dr. Daryl?" asked Anthor. "I'm not sure. Offhand, I don't see how it's possible. Even in cases of amnesia, there is suppression, but not removal. Drastic brain surgery, perhaps?" "Oh, something's been cut out," cried Anthor impatiently. "Yes, not in the physical sense, however. You know, the mule could have done just that. He could have suppressed completely all capacity for a certain emotion or attitude of mind, and leave nothing but just such a flatness. Or else the second foundation could have done it, is that it?" asked Turbor with a slow smile. There was no real need to answer that thoroughly rhetorical question. "What made you suspicious, Mr. Anthor?" asked Munn. "It wasn't I. It was Dr. Cleese. He collected brainwave patterns, much as the planetary police do, but along different lines. He specialized in intellectuals, government officials, and business leaders. You see, it's quite obvious that if the Second Foundation is directing the historical course of the galaxy, of us, that they must do it subtly and in as minimal a fashion as possible. If they work through minds, as they must, it is the minds of people with influence, culturally, industrially, or politically, and with those he concerned himself." "Yes," objected Munn. "But is there corroboration? How do these people act? I mean the ones with the plateau." "Maybe it's all a perfectly normal phenomenon." He looked hopelessly at the others out of his, somehow, childlike blue eyes, but met no encouraging in return. "I leave that to Dr. Daryl," said Anthor. "Ask him how many times he's seen this phenomenon in his general studies, or in reported cases in the literature over the past generation. Then ask him the chances of it being discovered in almost 1 out of every 1,000 cases among the categories Dr. Cleese studied." "I suppose that there is no doubt," said Daryl thoughtfully, "that these are artificial mentalities. They have been tampered with. In a way, I have suspected this." "I know that, Dr. Daryl," said Anthor. "I also know you once worked with Dr. Cleese. I would like to know why you stopped." There wasn't actually hostility in his question, perhaps nothing more than caution, but at any rate, it resulted in a long pause. Daryl looked from one to another of his guests, then said brusquely, "Because there was no point to Cleese's battle. He was competing with an adversary too strong for him. He was detecting what we, he and I, knew he would detect. That we were not our own masters. And I didn't want to know. I had my self-respect. I like to think that our foundation was captain of its collective soul, that our forefathers had not quite fought and died for nothing. I thought it would be most simple to turn my face away as long as I was not quite sure. I didn't need my position, since the government pension awarded to my mother's family in perpetuity would take care of my uncomplicated needs. My home laboratory would suffice to keep boredom away, and life would someday end. Then Cleese died. Semmick showed his teeth and said, "This fella Cleese, I don't know him. How did he die?" Anthor cut in. "He died. He thought he would. He told me half a year before that he was getting too close. Now we're too close too, aren't we?" suggested Munn, dry-mouthed, as his Adam's apple jiggled. "Yes," said Anthor flatly. "But we were anyway, all of us. It's why you've all been chosen. I'm Cleese's student. Dr. Darrell was his colleague. Joel Turbor has been denouncing our blind faith in the saving hand of the Second Foundation on the air until the government shut him off, through the agency, I might mention, of a powerful financier whose brain shows what Cleese used to call the Tamper Plateau. Homer Munn has the largest home collection of Muliana, if I may use the phrase to signify collected data concerning the mule, in existence, and has published some papers concerning speculation on the nature and function of the Second Foundation. Dr. Semmick has contributed as much as anyone to the mathematics of encephalographic analysis, though I don't believe he realized that his mathematics could be so applied." Semmick opened his eyes wide and chuckled gaspingly. "No, young fellow, I was analyzing intranuclear motions, the N-body problem, you know. I'm lost in encephalography." "Then we know where we stand. The government can, of course, do nothing about the matter. Whether the mayor or anyone in his administration is aware of the seriousness of the situation, I don't know. But this I do know. We five have nothing to lose and stand to gain much. With every increase in our knowledge, we can widen ourselves in safe directions. We are but a beginning, you understand." "How widespread," put in Turbor, "is this Second Foundation infiltration?" "I don't know. There's a flat answer. All the infiltrations we have discovered were on the outer fringes of the nation. The capital world may yet be clean, though even that is not certain, else I would not have tested you. You were particularly suspicious, Dr. Darrell, since you abandoned research with Cleese. Cleese never forgave you, you know. I thought that perhaps the Second Foundation had corrupted you, but Cleese always insisted that you were a coward. You'll forgive me, Dr. Darrell, if I explain this to make my own position clear. I personally think I understand your attitude, and if it was cowardice, I consider it venial." Darrell drew a breath before replying. "I ran away. Call it what you wish. I tried to maintain our friendship, however, yet he never wrote nor called me until the day he sent me your brainwave data, and that was scarcely a week before he died. If you don't mind," interrupted Homer Munn with a flash of nervous eloquence, I don't see what you think you're doing. We're a poor bunch of conspirators if we're just going to talk and talk and talk, and I don't see what else we can do anyway. This is very childish. Brainwaves and mumbo-jumbo and all that. Is there just one thing you intend to do?" Peleus Anthor's eyes were bright. "Yes, there is. We need more information on the Second Foundation. It's the prime necessity. The mule spent the first 5 years of his rule in just that quest for information, and failed, or so we have all been led to believe. But then he stopped looking. Why? Because he failed, or because he succeeded?" More talk," said Munn bitterly. "How are we ever to know, if you'll listen to me? The mule's capital was on Calgan. Calgan was not part of the Foundation's commercial sphere of influence before the mule, and it is not part of it now. Calgan is ruled at the moment by the man Stettin, unless there's another palace revolution by tomorrow. Stettin calls himself First Citizen, and considers himself the successor of the mule. If there is any tradition in that world, it rests with the superhumanity and greatness of the mule, a tradition almost superstitious in intensity. As a result, the mule's old palace is maintained as a shrine. No unauthorized person may enter. Nothing within has ever been touched." "Well?" "Well, why is that so? At times like these, nothing happens without a reason. What if it is not superstition only that makes the mule's palace inviolate? What if the Second Foundation has so arranged matters? In short, what if the results of the mule's 5-year search are within..." Puppycock! "Why not?" demanded Anthor. "Throughout its history, the Second Foundation has hidden itself and interfered in galactic affairs in minimal fashion only. I know that to us it would seem more logical to destroy the palace, or at the least, to remove the data. But you must consider the psychology of these master psychologists. They are Seldons. They are mules, and they work by indirection through the mind. They would never destroy or remove when they could achieve their ends by creating a state of mind. Huh? No immediate answer, and Anthor continued. And you, Mun, are just the one to get the information we need. I? It was an astounded yell. Mun looked from one to the other rapidly. I can't do such a thing. I'm no man of action, no hero of any teleview. I'm a librarian. If I can help you that way, all right, and I'll risk the second foundation, but I'm not going out into space on any quixotic thing like that. Now look, said Anthor patiently. Dr. Darrell and I have both agreed that you're the man. It's the only way to do it naturally. You say you're a librarian. Fine. What is your main field of interest? Muleana. You already have the greatest collection of material on the mule in the galaxy. It is natural for you to want more. More natural for you than for anyone else. You could request entrance to the Kalgan Palace without arousing suspicion of ulterior motives. You might be refused, but you would not be suspected. What's more, you have a one-man cruiser. You're known to have visited foreign planets during your annual vacation. You've even been on Kalgan before. Don't you understand that you need only act as you always have? But I can't just say, won't you kindly let me into your most sacred shrine, Mr. First Citizen? Why not? Because, by the galaxy, he won't let me. All right, then, so he won't. Then you'll come home and we'll think of something else. Mun looked about in helpless rebellion. He felt himself being talked into something he hated. No one offered to help him extricate himself. So, in the end, two decisions were made in Dr. Darrell's house. The first was a reluctant one of agreement on the part of Mun to take off into space as soon as his summer vacation began. The other was a highly unauthorized decision on the part of a thoroughly unofficial member of the gathering, made as she clicked off a sound receiver and composed herself for a belated sleep. This second decision does not concern us just yet. Chapter 10. Approaching Crisis. A week had passed on the second foundation, and the first speaker was smiling once again upon the student. You must have brought me interesting results, or you would not be so filled with anger. The student put his hand upon the sheaf of calculating paper he had brought with him and said, Are you sure that the problem is a factual one? The premises are true. I have distorted nothing. Then I must accept the results. And I do not want to. Naturally. But what have your wants to do with it? Well, tell me what disturbs you so. No, put your derivations to one side. I will subject them to analysis afterward. Meanwhile, talk to me. Let me judge your understanding. Well then, Speaker, it becomes very apparent that a gross overall change in the basic psychology of the First Foundation has taken place. As long as they knew of the existence of a Seldon plan, without knowing any of the details thereof, they were confident but uncertain. They knew they would succeed, but they didn't know when or how. There was, therefore, a continuous atmosphere of tension and strain, which was what Seldon desired. The First Foundation, in other words, could be counted upon to work at maximum potential. A doubtful metaphor, said the first speaker, but I understand you. But now, Speaker, they know of the existence of a second foundation in what amounts to detail, rather merely than as an ancient and vague statement of Seldon's. They have an inkling as to its function as the guardian of the plan. They know that an agency exists which watches their every step and will not let them fall. So they abandon their purposeful stride and allow themselves to be carried upon a litter. Another metaphor, I'm afraid. Nevertheless, go on. And that very abandonment of effort, that growing inertia, that lapse into softness and into a decadent and hedonistic culture, means the ruin of the plan. They must be self-propelled. Is that all? No, there is more. The majority reaction is as described. But a great probability exists for a minority reaction. Knowledge of our guardianship and our control will rouse among a few, not complacence, but hostility. This follows from Korolev's theorem. Yes, yes, I know the theorem. I'm sorry, Speaker. It is difficult to avoid mathematics. In any case, the effect is that not only is the Foundation's effort diluted, but part of it is turned against us, actively against us. And is that all? There remains one other factor of which the probability is moderately low. Very good. What is that? While the energies of the First Foundation were directed only to Empire, while their only enemies were huge and outmoded hulks that remained from the shambles of the past, they were obviously concerned only with the physical sciences, with us forming a new large part of their environment. A change in view may well be imposed upon them. They may try to become psychologists. That change, said the first speaker coolly, has already taken place. The student's lips compressed themselves into a pale line. Then all is over. It is the basic incompatibility with the plan. Speaker, would I have known of this if I had lived outside? The first speaker spoke seriously. You feel humiliated, my young man, because thinking you understood so much so well, you suddenly find that many very apparent things were unknown to you. Thinking you were one of the lords of the galaxy, you suddenly find that you stand near to destruction. Naturally, you will resent the ivory tower in which you lived, the seclusion in which you were educated, the theories on which you were reared. I once had that feeling. It is normal. Yet it was necessary that in your formative years you have no direct contact with the galaxy, that you remain here, where all knowledge is filtered to you and your mind carefully sharpened. We could have shown you this part failure of the plan earlier and spared you the shock now, but you would not have understood the significance properly, as you now will. Then you find no solution at all to the problem. The student shook his head and said hopelessly, none. Well, it is not surprising. Listen to me, young man. A course of action exists and has been followed for over a decade. It is not the usual course, but one that we have been forced into against our will. It involves low probabilities, dangerous assumptions. We have even been forced to deal with individual reactions at times, because that was the only possible way. And you know that psychostatistics, by its very nature, has no meaning when applied to less than planetary numbers. Are we succeeding? Gasped the student. There is no way of telling yet. We have kept the situation stable so far, but for the first time in the history of the plan, it is possible for the unexpected actions of a single individual to destroy it. We have adjusted a minimum number of outsiders to a needful state of mind. We have our agents, but their paths are planned. They dare not improvise. That should be obvious to you. And I will not conceal the worst. If we are discovered here, on this world, it will not only be the plan that is destroyed, but ourselves, our physical selves. So you see, our solution is not very good. But the little you have described does not sound like a solution at all, but like a desperate guess. No, let us say, an intelligent guess. When is the crisis, Speaker? When will we know whether we have succeeded or not? Well within the year, no doubt. The student considered that, then nodded his head. He shook hands with the speaker. Well, it's good to know. He turned on his heel and left. The first speaker looked out silently as the window gained transparency, past the giant structures to the quiet, crowding stars. A year would pass quickly. Would any of them, any of Selden's heritage, be alive at its end? Chapter 11. Stowaway. It was a little over a month before the summer could said to have started. Started, that is, to the extent that Homier Munn had written his final financial report of the fiscal year, seeing to it that the substitute librarian supplied by the government was sufficiently aware of the subtleties of the post. Last year's man had been quite unsatisfactory, and arranged to have his little cruiser, the Unimara, named after a tender and mysterious episode of 20 years past, taken out of its winter cobwebbery. He left Terminus in a sullen distemper. No one was at the port to see him off. That would not have been natural, since no one ever had in the past. He knew very well that it was important to have this trip in no way different from any he had made in the past, yet he felt drenched in a vague resentment. He, Homer Munn, was risking his neck in daring duery of the most outrageous sort, and yet he left alone. At least, so he thought. And it was because he thought wrongly that the following day was one of confusion, both on the Unamara and in Dr. Darrell's suburban home. This book is continued on cassette number 5.